Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Supernatural George. Today, we're going to be talking about Season 7, Episode 16, Out with the Old, written by Jenny Klein and Robert Singer, which is the third of four episodes that he has a writing credit for, and directed by John F. Showalter. So, on top of many other interesting things we'll discuss about this episode, it's also the episode where we lose Frank Devereaux, because Kevin McNally had other work and wasn't available to be in 720. But since we got Charlie out of the deal, I can't complain too much. Though my personal headcanon is that Frank, being the ultimate paranoid bastard, faked his death and went completely off-grid, because why not? So that's what I'm going with. He's out there with Victor Henriksen just watching the madness happen and doing what they can to covertly feed info to Sam and Dean so they can fix things. Okay? Okay. Now back to canon, and this episode specifically. On a major myth arc note, we get the absolute collapse of Sam's mental state now that his silence Lucifer button has failed. Because rather than actually deal with the trauma that breaking his wall inflicted on him, he's chosen to just ignore it for the better part of a year. So he's in no way prepared to actually process and deal with his trauma. I mean, when Dean got back from hell, he may have been reassembled by an angel, but he still carried the burden of everything that happened to him, and he processed and dealt with it all so that he wouldn't be reduced to a blubbering mess. But Sam just externalized it all and stuffed it in a hallucinatory version of his literal tormentor, and then gave it all the power over his experience of reality. So, because of my own mental health issues, I apologize in advance if this is really the extent to which that I can talk about it in any way, but suffice it to say that I sternly disapprove of Sam's coping mechanisms. I used to have a tag that was something like Sam versus reality for a reason. He so confidently trusts in his own understanding of everything, yet he's got some massive glaring holes in his perceptions that he doesn't seem capable of seeing, let alone dealing with. So, moving on, I guess. We finally learn what the Leviathan are up to and what those numbers that Bobby died to give them were about. We'll talk about how all that fits into Chuck's big story as yet another attempt to destroy Sam and Dean in the specific way he most enjoys as we run toward the end of the season and the defeat of the Leviathan, because it all fits the big spiral narrative pattern of Chuck's overarching tale. And last but certainly not least, we will point and yell about all the queer coding Dean gets again in this episode. Sam gets to be the outsider because addiction and mental health arcs, and Dean gets the outsider because queer parallels. Because those toe shoes call to Dean, and he's watched not only Black Swan, but arguably Swan Lake as well. Mr. I could have been a good dancer if I wanted from season 15, probably could have been an amazing dancer. The title of this one, Out with the Old, kind of feels prophetic, since we're approaching the end of Sarah Gamble's run, and in the very next episode, she'll be forced to bring Cass back, after the defining theme of her tenure had been to move away from the Heaven and Angels storylines. And she did so by trying to salt and burn Cass's character, villainizing him and punishing him with apparent death to wipe the slate clean for her own story. See how well that worked out for her, I guess, because part of handing the reins over to Carver for season 8 required bringing Cass back. Thank fuck. Anyway, we should really get to the then segment. We open with a reminder from way back, Bad Day at Black Rock, and our intro into what curse boxes are. They keep the evil mojo in when you lock a cursed object inside. We then get a reminder of the numbers that Bobby spent his dying breaths to give them, and Frank Devereaux figuring out what they represented, a field in Wisconsin recently purchased by a subsidiary of Richard Roman Enterprises. We see the rise of Dick, intercut with scary Leviathan mouths as he says, "A shark's gotta eat," but we don't yet know what they're planning to build on that land. We shift back to the beginning of Season 7 and Sam's Hallucifer problem, how he's been managing it all season with the magic scar button on his hand, and how the button broke last week when Sam let Lucifer in by talking directly to him. He told him to shut up. And now his one neat trick to stop the hallucination doesn't work anymore. Which brings us to now, with Lucifer cackling over the title card. We open in a ballet studio where a group of dancers are packing up their things after a practice, laughing about another dancer. The other girl apparently feels she's too good to dance with them, but she walks in as they're preparing to leave. She shrugs off their barbs with a superior air, and when they're gone, she prepares to dance, having just bought a new pair of shoes that she takes from a shopping bag. She warms up and puts on music, dims the lights, and begins dancing. Intercut with shots of the janitor mopping in the hall outside. Something is clearly wrong. She tries to stop dancing, but her feet keep moving as she clings to the bar and looks at her horrified reflection. She's whipped away against her will, forced to spin until her feet explode. The janitor sees the blood splatter, opens the door, and crosses himself at the scene of her lying dead, but the ballet shoes sit a few feet from her body, completely free of any stain, like she'd never even put them on. And then we cut to the title card. Again, one splat leads to another, and I'm going to be so glad when splat season ends. I'm kind of sick of it. Once again, we open the episode with Dean on the phone to Frank Devereaux looking for information. All he gets is random info that isn't helping him actually get Dick. Dick's funding an archaeological dig, opening a new Biggersons, a factory in Saudi Arabia, and a fishery in Jakarta, which is completely irrelevant to Sam and Dean. But Sam and Dean are in Oregon, and Frank's got no leads for them there. And there's still nothing about the land in Wisconsin. Sam comes back to the car with a coffee and a paper, and Dean remarks that Sam seems to be caffeinating for the record. This is like fifth coffee of the day already. Sam mentions that every time he closes his eyes to sleep, Lucifer just yells inside his head. And Dean, bless him, points out that it's not actually Lucifer, which Sam sort of dismissively acknowledges because he can't turn down the volume on him either way. But he does have something that might be their kind of case. Our cold open dancer with the exploded feet. Dean laughs and expresses that ballet dancers are nuts. And when Sam asks how Dean would know that, he says he watched Black Swan twice. Sam tries to go all judgmental on him for this, and Dean brushes it off as only being interested in the lesbian smut aspect of it, which Sam seems to believe and also roll his eyes at Dean over, because of course that's all Dean would be interested in a movie like that for. And this is just a classic performing Dean thing that we will watch unfold throughout this episode, because it becomes very clear that Dean isn't telling his brother the full truth about his interest in ballet here, because he knows that Sam would mock him for that. So it's easier to just put up this pre-assembled front. For all the fandom impression of Sam as the understanding or more open-minded of the two of them, Sam just repeatedly makes it impossible for me to see him that way. Sam is one judgmental little motherfucker. Like 95% of the reason Dean puts on the performance for him in the first place. The other 5% being that Sam tends to deliberately forget that he ever gets a peek behind that performance to see far deeper and more emotional marshmallow of a dude buried behind it, and almost immediately goes back to assuming the worst about Dean and buying right back into the performance again. And it always pisses me off. I'll give him a pass in this episode, though, because he's got some serious mental health issues happening here, and he's incredibly sleep-deprived. At the Portland police station, they wait to see the evidence from the dancer case, and we cut back to the evidence room, where the cop in charge and processing the evidence is looking after his elementary school-age daughter while she does her homework. She sees the toe shoes and immediately wants them. He tells her she can't touch them, but she looks enchanted. She excuses herself to go to the ladies' room while Sam and Dean see the photos from the crime scene. But when she gets to the bathroom, the shoes are magically waiting for her in the middle of the floor. She shuts the door and goes to put them on. They're too large for her, but as she laces them, they magically shrink to fit her. Sam and Dean go to the evidence room to see the shoes, but they're gone. The girl's father believes that she took them because, quote, she loves ballet. Sam and Dean find her still sitting on the floor of the bathroom and ask her to take the shoes off, but she's magically scooped up into the air and set down on her toes and begins to dance uncontrollably, just like our cold open victim. Sam and Dean both have to tackle and wrestle her to get the shoes off, while the poor girl keeps kicking Dean in the face and saying, sorry, sorry about it. But yeah, definitely a cursed object. Easy case to solve, right? But the shoes have a sticker from a store called Out With The Old. So, of course, they have to make sure that this store is not selling a bunch of cursed evil objects. The shop is having a going out of business sale, but when they pull up, the shoes they'd put in the trunk are magically on the back seat, and also magically grown to fit Dean's feet. He looks terrified, and Sam asks if he's, and sort of trails off, and Dean fills in, getting the strong urge to Prince Siegfried myself into oblivion? Yes. And Sam is sobered by the realization that Dean really did see Black Swan. Only Prince Siegfried is never mentioned by name in Black Swan. Dean would actually have to know the story of Swan Lake to know his name. Also, the show gives us the key to how the curse actually works. The shoes don't target anyone who sees them or even handles them. The little girl never even touched them when the shoes singled her out in the exact same way they did to Dean. She just, as her father said, loves ballet. She loves ballet, meaning the shoes target Dean in the exact same way because he loves ballet. And Sam never really gets that angle of it because he doesn't have to, you know? But we get it, hopefully. The shoes didn't just choose random victims. They didn't choose any of the cops who interacted with them, nor the janitor who found the first dancer's body. Neither did the antique shop owner who pulled them out of the curse box and sold them to the cold open dancer, and presumably didn't take any other precautions in handling them. They activated in the presence of a person who loves ballet. That's the key. So, however Dean tried to blow off his knowledge of dancers as only tied to a hot lesbian action scene in a single film, I believe it goes far deeper than that, and that This is what he truly feared Sam finding out about him. Once again, a queer coding moment wrapped in a performing Dean scene, and once again, Sam just missed the whole lesson of it. Though granted, they have bigger problems to worry about right that second. Like the real estate lady trying to convince the hardware store owner across the street to sell his property to her. He's not interested, and we get our first look at her interactions with her overburdened assistant. Poor George. She just treats him like dirt. As they get in the car, Sam and Dean cross the street right behind them, and they don't even notice. Another thing we notice in this shot, though, is that most of the businesses on that block have closing or going out of business signs on them, which is already a bit suspicious. Inside the antique shop, Sam goes full hostile interviewer mode without so much as a howdy-do, because to him, this is potentially a hostile situation. Also, he hasn't slept in days and is really starting to wear on him. But they could be dealing with a witch or someone capable of creating that sort of curse. Plus, you know, he's concerned about Dean, who can't take his eyes off those toe shoes. The poor shop owner is confused, but points them to a box his mother kept the shoes in. It's a curse box, of course. While Sam finds the box, Dean picks up the shoes like he can't help himself. Sam grabs them out of his hands and stuffs them in the box, slamming it shut, and then asks Dean, again, kind of hostily, if he's okay. Dean says he's pa-de-done, while smiling about it, while Sam twitches at that reply like he can't understand why Dean's so pleased with himself about that comment. Because, again, Dean loves ballet enough to make his usual sort of referential jokes about it, and Sam just doesn't get this one. That leaves the baffled shopkeep free to ask what the fuck is going on. Sam asks Scott where he got the shoes, and he explains he's getting rid of all of his mother's things because she passed away this last week. Dean comes out of the back room with a couple more empty curse boxes. I love the montage that we get next of a woman preparing a meal in her kitchen, because we have no idea which of these objects the camera slowly pans over is the cursed thing yet. There's knives, a meat grinder, a meat mallet, antique scissors, all while a woman ominously chops vegetables. A tea kettle whistles on the stove, and she walks mesmerized over to it, picks it up, burning her bare hands on the metal, and pours all the boiling water down her throat. And that was clearly our cursed object. Back at the shop, Scott is still confused, but has no idea where his mother got the curse boxes. She kept them in a safe, the inside of which we can see is painted with all sorts of warding sigils. And Scott just thought it was all junk. Dean tells him that junk is killing people. So Scott cooperates and shares the names and addresses of everyone who bought the cursed objects. Sam and Dean show up at Tea Kettle Lady's house to find her dead. Dean picks up the kettle with a pair of rubber gloves, and once that's secured, they split up to handle the last two potential victims, hopefully in time to save them. Dean tells Sam to take the gramophone lady, and he'll take the, quote, vintage gentleman's magazine sold to Peter Yankit on Johnson Lane, and just how many more masturbation jokes could they have possibly squeezed into that single sentence? At least Dean knows he doesn't want to find out how old porn kills you. We cut to the gramophone house, where a mom switches it on and then runs upstairs with a load of laundry, leaving her young son in the room with the cursed thing. He drops his iPad, walks over to listen closely to the music, goes into some kind of trance, gets a big knife, and walks slowly up behind his mother with it raised over his head like he's gonna stab her. Sam just bursts into the house without even knocking. I assume he heard the gramophone music playing and knew there was danger. But he saves the woman's life, leaves them both kind of confused, and goes right to the gramophone. He's pulling on rubber gloves as the kid is whining at Sam that the gramophone's his. Sam barks back that the kid should probably be grateful, but that Sam's too tired to lecture him about it. Once again, reminding us why Sam is acting so tetchy. While he's packing the cursed music box up, Dean is leaving Peter Yankit's house with a curse box full of old porn, and he's got it like held out away from him like he doesn't even want to risk this affecting him. He's already been hit by one curse today. He doesn't want to get this one. He apparently also had arrived just in time to keep the man from yanketing himself to death. Over the phone to Sam, they agree to meet back up at the shop. Sam's got a ways to go. He was on foot. So Dean arrives first, putting the magazine and kettle back in the safe, while Scott realizes that his mom wasn't just a whack job, and we get some more of his backstory. He tells Dean that he feels bad now that he'd pushed her to sell the shop. She hadn't wanted to, until one day out of the blue, she finally just agreed to do it, and then died mysteriously the next day. Didn't even get to enjoy the money or her retirement. But maybe if he hadn't pushed her, she wouldn't have sold it or crashed her car the next day. Dean is intrigued and suspicious about all of this, though, especially the real estate lady who convinced her to sell. Dean gives Scott some great advice, not to feel guilty, but to just live your life to make his mom proud of him, or at least not to embarrass her. Dean also tells him not to touch anything in the safe, that they're going to get a U-Haul to take away all the cursed things, and Scott wholeheartedly agrees. As Dean leaves, he sees the Joyce Bickleby sold sign in the window and knows who he needs to investigate next, especially after he sees the same sign in windows all up and down the street. We then cut to the real estate office of Joyce Bickleby and her hapless assistant, George. The man from the hardware store earlier was about to sign the sales contract, but he realized at the last moment that the store is his life and he doesn't really want to sell, at which point Joyce holds out a hand for him to shake, wishes him the best of luck with the rest of his life. What little of it there is left. She's practically crushing his hand, and as he winces in pain, Joyce transforms into him, reaches up, and snaps the man's neck. She then signs the sales contract on his behalf before transforming back into Joyce. Meanwhile, George is distressed that Joyce is ready to kill everyone who won't sell to her. He mentions the woman at the antiques shop who they apparently did the exact same thing to. So the mother didn't decide to sell. They framed her and then set up her death. And then George mentions that Mr. Roman doesn't like it when they call attention to themselves. Mr. Roman, being Dick, the Leviathan, they're Leviathans. Surprise. They get rid of the body, take it back to the man's house, and put him in bed with a lit cigar, and let the fire cover their crime. Later on, we see fire and police lights outside of Joyce's window as she laughs about how smoking can be hazardous to your health. She takes a sip of her coffee, which George has apparently prepared incorrectly, so he gets a lecture that she's already been through four assistants before him, and he's not doing much better than they did. Apparently, she either bibbed or ate the last four. She gives George a nearly impossible-to-fill coffee order, sends him across town for it, and then demands far more than what's physically possible from the guy. Though she really does drive home the metaphor of Leviathans as corporate capitalist evil awfulness. Because, I mean, I really want to punch her in the face. We then cut to Sam driving a stolen truck, yawning, struggling to maintain focus, and turning up some very loud rock music. As soon as he does, his phone rings, and it's Dean, who's sitting in a coffee shop doing some research. He shares the bad news that their case isn't done. There's something a lot bigger happening in town, starting with the real estate company suddenly buying up Main Street. Sam is too zoned out to reply, and then finally gives a nonsensical dismissal to Dean. Dean is confused by this and asks if Sam is okay. And Sam tells him that sleep deprivation is a torture technique, and this does not bode well for Sam at all. Meanwhile, Dean attempts to do more research on the realtor and runs into a firewall. He calls Frank to ask how to crack through the corporate firewall, because apparently the real estate company is a subsidiary of GeoThrive, Inc. Back in Sam's truck, he's falling asleep at the wheel, swerving all over the road, and of course, this is the moment his hallucination actually lets him fall asleep, until he nearly plows head-on into a semi-truck, only swerving at the last second. We then cut back to poor hapless George, trying to get the complicated coffee, where the equally put-upon barista accidentally gave him an extra pump of sugar-free syrup. George tries to demand that he make a new drink, because he knows Joyce will be extremely displeased with his fuck-up that she will blame on him, as if it's his fault that the barista was put upon too and, you know, accidentally hit an extra shot. But the barista has a very long line of people waiting and tells George the extra shot's on the house. Eventually, George sucks it up and starts to leave until he realizes that the next person in line behind him was Sam Winchester, ordering a triple red eye. And to think, the whole time he was waiting in that line himself, he didn't notice the guy behind him was Sam frickin' Winchester. Poor schlub. George follows Sam back to the antique store and calls Joyce to tell her the good news. She's only interested in her coffee, doesn't trust George's assessment of the Winchester situation, and George is worried that the Winchesters are there for them. But Joyce is positive that they aren't. George thinks he's going to get to eat Sam Winchester, but Joyce yells at him not to and orders him back to the office. When he gets there, she picks right back up with the lecture about chain of command and demeaning George's intelligence, which she sees proof of when she tastes the coffee he apparently couldn't even get right. Nothing can possibly please Leviathan Joyce. Meanwhile, we've seen George clean up Joyce's messes all episode long, so if anyone deserved a bibbing, it was her, honestly. Back at the cafe, Dean's ogling some pie in a display case while Frank calls with an update. Poor Dean will not get his pie yet again. Frank tells him he couldn't access the GeoThrive site because, if you dig down deep, it's all dick. It's owned by Roman Enterprises. They just can't figure out why the Leviathans are buying up empty fields in Wisconsin and mom and pop shops in Portland. Frank advises Sam and Dean to get the hell out of town, but Dean insists on staying as long as people are dying, and he wants answers about what the Leviathans are up to anyway. Frank hangs up with a cheerful, "Fine, call me if you don't die." But Sam has arrived at the coffee shop, and Dean catches him up. Sam can't muster an ounce of attention or interest. He's just too exhausted. which has Dean concerned for him. He tries to send Sam to a motel to crash for a while, but Sam says it's pointless. Lucifer won't let him sleep. And again, it's not Lucifer. It's a piece of Sam's own mind, or soul, which he has completely failed to accept or admit to himself. Sam says that Lucifer is singing Stairway to Heaven right now. It might be a great song, but not 50 times in a row. Before they can really address that, Sam's phone rings, and it's Scott at the antique shop. He sounds scared, says he looked in a mirror that he thinks may have been cursed, and now he wants to rip his own face off. Sam tells him they're on the way, and Dean's already being judgmental that Scott touched something that he wasn't supposed to. But then we cut back to the shop and see George and Joyce there, and they're the ones who ordered Scott to make that call. They bind and gag Scott, and George is grumpy about yet one more body they'll have to clean up. Joyce goes over her plan to kill Scott, but to have George replace him, which she probably thinks is solving two problems at once by getting rid of an underperforming assistant and eliminating a potential source of problems for them if Scott were to blab what he knows. Sam and Dean arrive at the shop and immediately know how much trouble they're in. Joyce introduces themselves as the faces who will be eating them, opens up her big awful Leviathan mouth, and a fight ensues. Joyce wrestles with Dean and George with Sam, but George stops Sam and points out a big bucket full of the borax solution that they love throwing at Leviathans and tells Sam to dunk his head in it before Joyce sees what he's doing. She's busy throwing Dean around, and Sam does what George said to. And when Joyce finally catches a glimpse, she thinks even less of George that he let himself get burnt like that. But George then quickly points out to Sam a sword in a glass case, which Sam smashes, and then uses the sword to behead Joyce before she could cross into the next room to kill Dean. Poor Scott had to watch all of that go down. As Dean puts Joyce's head in a tote bag, Dean calmly advises him to make himself scarce, leave town, and he protests that he can't uproot his whole life. Dean tells him of course he can, it's easier than you think. And he also tells him not to stop running until you get somewhere you don't speak the language. Because as Sam will tell him, the Leviathans do not leave loose ends, as he stands guard over George, still holding that sword, waiting for George to set a foot out of line. I guess at least Scott's got the money his mom made selling the shop to keep him going for a while. But poor dude. I hope someday he'll realize that it's safe to come home because the Leviathans got taken down. But I can't imagine how he'd ever learn that information on his own, you know? Oh well, I hope he enjoyed the rest of his life in Belize or wherever. When Scott leaves, they ask George why he helped them. He replies that he wanted to know what Joyce tasted like. And, oh boy, does George finally want to get out from underneath her thumb. When Dean's like, what? George answers very matter-of-factly, do you have a better way to make her stay dead? And of course we know, no, they do not have a better way to make Leviathan stay dead. And I can't understand why they didn't just let George eat her head, you know? Like, it would have solved one of their problems anyway. Sam's like, okay, so what, you're on our side now or something? And George is like, no. But now I don't have to clean up her messes anymore, or get eaten, or bibbed. But George didn't want to take her on solo, and thanks them for the assist. He tells them you're welcome for saving them from her, and asks for her head. Sam holds the sword up to his neck, and Dean's like, Yeah, that's not going to happen. They've got some more questions for George. They ask what Dick has planned in Wisconsin, and poor George has no idea where Wisconsin even is. That is way far above his pay grade. So Sam angrily asks if he's going to keep killing people who won't sell their property to him. And George takes a bit of blood off the sword and licks it, before calmly telling them that killing people's not part of the agenda. That's Joyce's thing, and they don't have to worry about that with him. He also says they're freaking out about the wrong things, missing the bigger picture. It's not just in that town that the Leviathan are doing weird shit like this. It's everywhere. He tells them to keep their heads down and stay down. Dean gets up in his face and threatens him with more borax if he doesn't tell them what they're planning in that town. George finally relents and tells them a research center. The Leviathan intend to cure diseases, including cancer, which confuses the heck out of Sam and Dean. Why would Dick want to cure cancer? And smug little George, with a cocky smile on his face, says, because the Leviathans are only there to help. Yeah, sure. And we have no idea what happened to George. Did they let him walk? Did they add his head to the bag with Joyce's? There's no telling, and I kind of enjoy not knowing for sure, but I'm still about 95% convinced that they just didn't let him go. The next day, they pack the safe into a U-Haul, and they're nervous about what it means when monsters want to cure cancer. Dean tells Sam to sleep on it all the way to Frank's, but Sam can't. Dean's trying to stay upbeat and supportive, says he'll find a soft rock station because that always knocks Sam out. But before he gets in the truck, Dean looks around, kind of rolling his eyes like he knows this is not a tenable situation for much longer. As they drive off, Bad Moon Rising starts to play, which feels like a super bad omen, because the last time we heard this song in canon was the season 1 finale and then the season 2 opener, when the Impala got broadsided by a semi driven by a demon, and Dean was on his deathbed. When they pull up to Frank's trailer late that night in the pouring rain, also great omens, I'm sure, they get no answer from him when they bang on his door. Music's blaring from inside the trailer. Guess what song? And eventually Dean opens the door and goes in to find total destruction. Both blood and Leviathan goo splattered all around Frank's smashed up computers as Bad Moon Rising plays us out. As Dean says, not good. And that's where the episode ends. They've officially lost the one last outside connection they've had who'd been helping them, and Sam's sanity is beginning to fray completely. Dean is in a bad way about all of it. Gosh, wouldn't this be a great time for them to get some unexpected assistance from a completely mysterious source? Well, good thing next week is Season 7, Episode 17, The Born Again Identity, where Dean will finally get one thing back. Well, sort of. He almost gets two things back, but then almost immediately loses one of them again. But we'll talk about that next week. For now, let's look at what we know of Chuck's story that he loves retelling on every level of the narrative, over and over again, in new and, let's call it, moderately creative ways every season. One brother dies, and the other must somehow muddle on alone ad infinitum, rinse and repeat every time they miraculously wiggle out of his plans for them and survive to fight another day. Because in retrospect, the Leviathan were Sarah's attempt to redirect the narrative into a new direction. Kripke, the original creator, was OG Chuck in the story. Sarah's probably Dick Roman in a way, trying to force the entire story to her liking, and exiting after just two seasons. Carver, he's Metatron, the marshmallow upstart trying to fill the original creator's shoes, bringing the story back to its roots, and literally writing himself in as the new, albeit absolutely twisted, god of the narrative. And then Dab takes over. He brings back Chuck even. Not because he is trying to play Chuck now, because he also brings us Billy, a reaper elevated to the mantle of death, apparently destined to kill God, or at the very least, to bring the series to a close. And I think that Dab always intended to stay on until the show ended. But if he was Billy, then who did Chuck become? The actual powers that be. The network that held the reins and veto power over narratives, and the purse strings, the power of life and death over the show itself. But Dab plants this notion that Chuck has always been controlling events to his liking. Maybe he couldn't truly control Sam and Dean, couldn't, like, just stick his hand up their butt and puppet them around, but he could control things around them and things that happen to them. He could nudge events to fit his narrative and push the characters in a direction he wanted them to go. He planted entire narrative arcs and took credit for them in text, including the Leviathans. They were his plot twist, a weird failsafe triggered by Cass's uninformed overreach into purgatory for the power to try and bend the narrative to his will. So here we are, almost to the downfall of this particular attempt to drive Sam and Dean to choose the ending that Chuck always wanted. Only they weren't apparently moving fast enough for Chuck's taste, so they needed a little nudge. And once again, Chuck probably rolled his eyes and pulled the bottle off the shelf where he'd captured Cass when he exploded in that lake and threw him into Sam and Dean's path at just the right moment to nudge things back on course. I don't even know what else to say on this one, so until next time, you can find me on Tumblr at MittensMorgul or at SPN George. You can find me on Discord and Blue Sky as MittensMorgul, or you can email me at mittensmorgul@gmail.com. And I look forward to talking to everybody again real soon. What's the deal with the curse boxes? We never see this collection again. They're never mentioned again. We never see the safe again. Do they just lock them up in some storage unit somewhere? Throw away the key? Do they find a way to completely destroy these objects? Do they just dig a hole and throw the whole safe in? Find a volcano and chuck it in? Like, curse boxes feel like a small scale of one of Chuck's favorite plot devices. Locking things up that he can't figure out how to control. He did it to Amara with the Mark, to the Leviathans in Purgatory, to Lucifer in the cage, and on and on and on. And he's gonna do it to Dean and Cass at the end of the season. But nothing on this show ever stays locked up. Locks always fail, or break, or are broken. Even the first episode where we learn about curse boxes, it's only because some ding-dong decided to just open it because he didn't know any better. So, like, locking stuff up is always a terrible idea. Just begging for trouble. Kicking the trouble down the road for some poor schlub in the future to have to deal with. And in Supernatural, most of the time the schlub in question is Sam and or Dean. Oh well. We got a few more things that are going to have their locks sprung by the end of the season, so I'll have more time to complain about it in the very near future. And I enjoy complaining. Anyway, have a good one, everyone.